It's a real honor for us to have with on campus today, and Dr. Jerry Tidwell. I know that all of you know him. He's was my pastor for my time here and at Union. He's just last night I was at church at West Jackson and talking in the hallway with one of the deacons there, and they had heard that Jerry was going to be speaking with us today, and they on the issues, the topic of evangelism and outreach, and in the conversation they said, you know, he really needs to be talking with folks about outreach, because you look at this church is just a real testimony of his leadership, and that he came to a very small, struggling church and has built a great church. And when the Lord called him away from being our pastor, the enthusiasm and support for the outreach has continued to be strong. And even in the first year after he left as pastor, we had 319 additions. And folks would tell you that it's because of the farm, it's the climate, it's the people in the church who are going out. He's a dear friend of mine. As you know, he is author of the Grow Outreach Ministry, and I've been thrilled to have him on campus today. So if you will, join me in welcoming Dr. Tidwell to West Union.
Well, thank you, Dr. Fowler. It's so good to see so many of you again. After a while, I feel like I'm sort of coming back home. I have to tell you, Dr. Kelly, I told him he about shot my whole load tonight. I really enjoyed hearing the things that he shared this morning about the farm. And it is amazing that he and I have not communicated about today, and that's probably a good thing. But even in not doing that, how much these two things sort of pull together that we're doing, and so it's really an honor for me to get to be here today. As a matter of fact, the title of my presentation this morning, I used the word axiom to try to impress Dr. Kelly a little bit, but I hope that maybe you sort of pick up on what that word is all about. But it's a good word, and you're going to understand how this word applies to evangelism and outreach for me this morning. I was in a conference Saturday night in Springfield, Tennessee, and someone asked me the question that I don't know that I've ever been asked before. They asked me, you know, out of what type of atmosphere and spiritual climate did Grow basically come to life? And let me say in the onset here, Grow is not anything that anyone has not done before. It just sort of organized a little differently and put together in a module to make it work. But I started thinking about where Grow originated, and it's sort of interesting. I didn't have an epiphany or anything like that. I was in a church in Santo, Texas, was finishing up my doctorate of ministry degree, and to be honest with you, I was at one of the lowest points in my life in ministry. I had reached the point, like so many pastors, I was preaching. I felt like I was doing an adequate job preaching, felt like I was doing an adequate job pastoring and taking care of our church, but I felt like I was doing a real poor job of leading my church and fulfilling the Great Commission. Now, we were baptizing some people and all that, but as I looked at it on Sunday morning, I realized the people that I was preaching to week after week, they were not really involved in the Great Commission. And I'm going to tell you, I felt pretty miserable. As a matter of fact, at that very same time, in those few days where I was so down, there was a school back in Alabama who called me and wanted me to come back and take over and go back to high school football coaching. To be honest with you, I sure thought about it because I knew I could do that okay. But I didn't feel like I was being very successful as a pastor. And so it was out of that period of a little discouragement, of feeling like I wasn't doing a very good job leading in the area of the Great Commission, that God sort of gave me some principles, some sort of backed away from everything I'd done before and said, hey, here's the way Jesus said doing it, and what's it going to take? What's it going to take to get people involved in outreach and evangelism? And so that's where Grow sort of came forth and came to fruition. And I'm not really, I'm actually not going to talk specifically about Grow today. Some of the things I'm going to share are certainly as a part of the Grow Outreach Ministry, but today the session is four axioms for kingdom outreach, and the text I want to start off with is one you know very, very well, Matthew chapter 16. And there's so many ways this text can be preached and talked about and used, but you know, it is Peter's confession of faith. And I believe it's not only Peter's confession of faith and the right answer to Jesus' question, but I believe that Jesus allows Peter to ask to answer this question that Jesus asked to serve as a model and a foundation for us understanding what the church really is all about, the foundation. Because Jesus basically says, who do people say that I, the Son of Man, am? And they go on to say, well, some say that you're Elijah or John the Baptist or one of the prophets. And then Jesus, you can imagine Jesus sort of looking at Peter. He asked the question to everyone, but you can just sort of feel he's looking at Peter when he says, but who do you say that I, the Son of Man, am? And then Peter said, you are Christ, Son of the living God. And then Jesus goes on to say that Peter was blessed, and this confession of faith, and Jesus said that you are Petros, upon this rock I'll build my church. But what was it Jesus was saying? Now, we as Baptists do not believe that Jesus was specifically saying that, Peter, you're the man. And, you know, in the church, the success of the church, forget the other disciples, the success of the church depends upon you doing what I tell you. But I do believe that Jesus was identifying the fact that it would be people like Peter, men like him, and his confession. And this confession would be the foundation on which Jesus would build the church. And so, as I thought about that, and then Jesus goes on to say that the church is in the offensive posture, not the defensive posture, and the fact that the gates of hell will not be able to prevail against the onslaught and the movement of the church. And as I considered that, I considered that there really is a foundation for kingdom outreach. I mean, there are some things about outreach. And Dr. Kelly shared a little bit about that this morning, that picture of the farm. There are some methodologies like grow or faith or share Jesus without fear or EE. There's some methodologies that will change and sort of evolve over time, but there are some things, there are some principles about the Great Commission and kingdom building and kingdom outreach that will not change. And that's what I want to focus on a little bit this morning. Dr. E.Y. Mullins wrote a book back in 1915, 20, somewhere along in there, called The Axioms of Religion. And reading that book and that work, I sort of began to understand what an axiom is. And an axiom, let me share this because it'll make sense about why I use this word. An axiom is a truth that is so evident that there's no need to prove it over and over again. Okay? So an axiom is something that I don't have to convince you that it's true. When I say it, you'll say, oh yeah, I know that's true. And so there's no need to prove it over and over again. So when it comes to kingdom outreach and kingdom building for the cause of Christ, there are some things. We don't have to agree on everything, but there are some things that we will agree on today, that we will always agree on, that the Apostle Paul, Peter, and the disciples, these things apply to them. They're axioms. They're truths that are never ending about kingdom outreach that will not change. Dr. Kelly focused on a couple of those, but I want to sort of hit these four this morning. The first one, the first axiom, I think, of kingdom outreach, and there probably are many more, but these are the four I want to focus on, is the axiom of the absolute purpose of God, which is redemption. The axiom of the absolute purpose of God being redemption. Now, let me sort of step back here and say to you that I believe that one of the problems with our concept of outreach and evangelism and church building is I think sometimes we get a little bit limited in our view of salvation history. You see, we talk about church growth and we think New Testament almost exclusively. But it has occurred to me, and I'm sure many of you, that this idea of reaching people has been around even longer than New Testament time. You see, salvation history goes back even to Genesis chapter 3. You know, when When God basically pronounced to the serpent, when he talks about Adam and Eve, he shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. That's a statement involving God's plan of redemption, meaning that God has always sought to redeem mankind, you and me. You know, we've often said, and I know you've probably shared this in a testimony, that, and I've said this, you know, I believe when Jesus was on the cross, he knew me then as he knows me now. Well, it occurred to me that God knew me in Genesis 3 as well. For instance, you remember in Genesis chapter 15, the story where Abraham, God instructs Abraham about this covenant, and God tells him to take these animals and to cut them in half, and he forms this little trough between these pieces of slaughtered animals. And that was a ritual that would be used in that day to sort of be covenant binding. And so what happens is that he tells Abraham to do this, and Abraham sort of sits back and kind of wondering what's going to happen. And then Abraham notices that the torch or the presence of God passes through that meat. Now let me sort of sidetrack from that just a little bit. In the Old Testament, there are three types of covenants. There's a covenant between equals, which some of us would be familiar with. There is a covenant that would be a covenant that would be where the lesser powerful would submit himself to the greater one. Now, we know about that one too, don't we? We go to get a bank loan and, you know, they've got all the power, you know. So they say, we want your house, we want your kids, you know. So they're in charge if we want the money. But there's a third type of covenant that is sort of foreign to us, but it's not foreign to Abraham. It's a covenant where the greater one submits himself to the lesser one in covenant. That's what happens in Genesis 15. You notice Abraham is not the one who passes through the meat, because what they were saying, and this is almost sort of shout stuff here, is what God was saying, when he passed through the meat, God was saying, may the same thing happen to me that's happened to these animals if I do not fulfill my part of this covenant. Now, that tells me that God loves me a lot. It tells me that he loves you a lot. It tells me that God thought about reaching people. God thought about redeeming mankind way before the cross. The cross just becomes the method through which God chooses to do that. The salvation history understands the absolute purpose of God is redemption. That hasn't changed. Now, I know the openness of God movement out there says that God is sort of used to changing his mind. He doesn't do that. God has always sought to reach people, to bring us into relationship to himself. So the first axiom, foundational principle for me as I think about church growth and I think about outreach and all that we do in the church, is that it is God's passion, it is God's purpose that mankind be redeemed. So I believe that's an axiom. I don't think that's up for debate. I think most of us would agree that that's an absolute purpose of God, redemption. But the second one is one that Dr. Kelly touched on. The second axiom is the axiom of guaranteed harvest. The axiom of guaranteed harvest. I was so glad to hear him share what I've been talking to pastors about really the last few years, is that it is a shame. It is a shame for us to expect a harvest where there has been no sowing. In Psalm 126, you know, the passage, psalmist says that we will sow in tears and reap in joy. And I think there's sort of a causal relationship between those two things, that if we sow in tears and we have the passion and heart of God, that we will reap in joy. And then in Galatians 6:7, when Paul says, be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatever man sows, that will he also reap. Which says to us, this whole idea of sowing and reaping is not man's idea. Do you realize that is a principle that really permeates every part of life? I mean, we apply it to evangelism, but you know, it's the idea that you can kick up some soil and drop a seed down, cover it up, water it, and take care of it, and hope that seed comes up. Man did not think of that. That's God's idea. And so it even applies to business. You realize that when businesses sort of practice this idea of sowing seeds and reaping benefits, that concept is God's idea. And it applies to outreach. It applies to reaching people, which means that, yes, we can sow seeds and we can do the labor and we can know that God will bring forth a harvest. You know, Charles Finney is the one who made the statement that we can set the sails for revival, but only God can make the wind blow. And I think it's a little bit shameful that many of us basically say to God, okay, God, you make the wind blow, and when I see the wind blow, I'll put my sails up and I'll catch the wind. You see, I believe that one of the ways, and obviously prayer is a part of that, but one of the ways in which we set the sails for revival is sowing seeds. I mean, that's saying to God, God, we expect a harvest. God, we expect that you are able and you're capable of doing your part in the harvest. In Matthew 13:58, you know the story about Jesus going back to his hometown of Nazareth. And I think probably verse 58 of chapter 13 may be one of the saddest verses of the New Testament, at least to me. Because it says that Jesus left Nazareth. And it says there, you remember that? He says, he did not many mighty works there because of what? Their unbelief. They weren't expecting anything, and they didn't get anything. And I share that in relationship to this idea of sowing and reaping, because I think sometimes we come together on Sunday mornings or Sunday night, and we pray and we ask God to bring revival, and we ask God to save lost souls. And we have the audacity to do that when sometimes we've done nothing during the week and sowing seeds to anticipate that harvest. So what I'm sharing with you this morning is that I can't tell you the burden that it took off me to realize that the harvest was not my responsibility. You know, and in other words, the life-changing aspect of that work is not my, that's not mine. That's God's part. Now, we lead people down that road. We share the plan of salvation. We even lead them in an invitation. But that life-changing experience, that's God's idea. That's God's part. And God says that He will do that. So our job is the job of sowing and reaping, realizing that there will be harvest. There will be a harvest if we're faithful in the sowing. So put the seeds down. Sow the seeds. And the next time that I share with you, what I'm going to do, this may be a complete catastrophe, but what I'm going to do the next time is I want to put some sort of legs on these four principles and share with you some things that I've done, some things that we've done that accomplishes that. And we'll talk about some ways of sowing seeds the next time that I'm up, and some of the ways in which we can be effective in the farming process. But the third axiom, and I have to confess, this is one that this is one of those that I don't completely understand all the repercussions of this, but it is the axiom of spiritual reproduction. And there are so many texts that I could use for this. We could talk about Matthew 28, we could talk about Acts 1:8. You know, the idea of the Great Commission and your being a part of that and my being a part of that really is not an optional, not an option in terms of us choosing to do that. As a disciple, that's what we're supposed to do. The fact is, we've let people off the hook here. We basically have said, you know, we'll take 10% of the people and we'll accomplish the Great Commission. We'll do the kingdom building in the church. And the fact of the matter is, this idea of spiritual reproduction, that we're to lead others into a personal relationship with Christ, like Andrew and Peter. I mean, that's something God has called us all to do. You know, one of the best works, I know Dr. Kelly would have probably agree with this, that this was church growth evangelism before church growth was cool, you know. Robert Coleman wrote a book years ago called The Master's Plan of Evangelism. And some of you have this in your studies. Me, I haven't, you haven't read it, but it's just a small book. But in that, he talks about this concept of spiritual reproduction and assimilation. But he talked about it before a lot of us were really talking about it. And it was popular to talk about church growth. And it's really a fine little book about the principles of evangelism and church growth. But he talks about this concept of spiritual reproduction and how this was the methodology of Jesus all along. This idea of focusing on 12 men and not 12,000 in terms of kingdom building. Jesus had this idea of kingdom building and spiritual reproduction. I think where we have, and I have to tell you, one of the areas in which I have messed up, and one of the things that really prompted me to do something different in the area of grow was this idea that people were not coming to be a part of outreach or visitation. We're not really taking part in the Great Commission. You know how it is. We get all fired up and we're ready to start a church outreach program, church visitation, and we get up and we preach at them 2 or 3 weeks and we get them feeling just guilty enough. They all show up on Monday night, Tuesday night, get this big crowd of folks. Next week, you get about half that amount. The next week, you got about half of that half. The week after that, you got half of the half of the half. And before too long, it's just you and that one deacon, and neither one of you really want to be there either, you know. And that's the cycle. That's the cycle of outreach and visitation and church growth. And it occurred to me that really we were asking people to do something that we have not really equipped them to do. And I would say to you, one of the, and it's not unique, but it is one of the success little underlying things about GROW is that it finds a way to involve people who are not necessarily comfortable just right on the spur of the moment going out knocking on a stranger's door and says, do you know who Jesus is, you know? But it finds a way to bring them along to cultivate them in discipleship and let them be a part of kingdom outreach. And see the success and feel the passion and make their way into kingdom building. I share a little illustration. Back when I was coaching high school football, we had a young man named Eddie who was a ninth grader. And we were attempting to turn around a program that had not won a game in 5 years, had not had a winning season in 15 years. And we were going in there and trying to do something with that. And so by virtue of that fact, we were taking some of the younger guys and we were bringing them in, trying to get them some experience. And you got to be careful how you do that. You take a ninth grader and you put him against a 12th grader on the football field, and you can do some damage to the ninth grader mentally and physically too. So we were kind of being sort of careful about that. We had this young man named Eddie who was a freshman, and he was like most 14, 15-year-old boys. He was clumsy. His voice was changing. He had sort of big feet and just a little bit overweight and slow as Christmas. And Eddie was one of those kids that didn't have, at least our perception was, he had absolutely no football talent whatsoever. So we did with him what we do with every kid that you don't know what to do with. We put him with a lineman. You know, that's where you put the kids you don't know what to do with. So we put him with a lineman, and Eddie starts working out with the linemen, and he does that for his freshman year. And when he's a sophomore, he becomes one of our tight ends. Again, he's pretty slow, a little bit clumsy, but he tries hard. You know, he works hard. He's at practice. He's great work ethic. And during his sophomore year, he sort of started getting in the game as a tight end. And we noticed we didn't throw the tight end a whole lot, but when we did, he caught the ball. And even though he was pretty slow, he was hard to bring down just because of his tenacity. And so that was his position during his sophomore year. Didn't play a whole lot, but was successful while he was in there. And by the time he was a junior in high school, he was the starting tight end, and he was pretty good at it. A smart kid, worked hard. And so we moved him to fullback because he was such a good blocker. Again, he was tough and hard to bring down. Still slow as Christmas, we moved him to fullback. Well, we had, and I got to, again, take a little side note here. We used a counter-style offense. Now, you ladies are not going to like this at all, but guys, it's sort of a trapping offense, you know. It's one of those offenses where when you counter-style, you can take an average tailback and you can make him look like an All-American if everything works right. I mean, really. And so we had this tailback who really did. He wasn't just great, but we made him look good because of the style of offense we had. And so Eddie was the fullback blocking for the tailback. And halfway through his junior year, our tailback has a knee injury that sort of puts him out of commission completely. And our second string tailback is a 10th grader who is as nutty as a fruitcake, and we can't put him in there. And so our only option was to take this lineman turned tight end, turned fullback, and now use him as a tailback. Because he knew the system, he worked hard, still slow. And so his junior year, he was a tailback, and you know what? He was good. Didn't make any long runs, but he was tough to bring down. And by the time he was a senior, we left him as a starting tailback. He did get a little faster. He worked hard. But the whole point of the story is, by the end of his senior year in high school, I'd already left to go to Texas to start seminary, but Eddie Sermitt was an all-state tailback in the state of Alabama, all because of great coaching. No. It was because when he was a 9th grader, and there was no perceived talent whatsoever in this kid, we found a way that he could plug in. We found a role that he could play on our team at that point when I said we didn't see the all-state tailback. And the point I'm making in that in our churches on Sunday morning, every Sunday morning there are some all-state soul winners sitting out there. They just don't know it yet. And sometimes we throw them in the fire too quickly, and what I'm sharing with you is find a way. I don't care if you do it through letter writing or phone calling. Find a way that you can involve them in kingdom outreach and evangelism at a level that they're comfortable with initially, but find a way to involve them so that they can become the soul winner that God wants them to be. So it is the axiom of spiritual reproduction, of finding a way to help people reproduce themselves spiritually. And understand that if they're not doing it, then they're not following God's plan and God's will. We're all supposed to be a part of the Great Commission. So I started with the idea that night that I was so discouraged. You know, I started with the idea that God had not written an excuse for anyone in my church to not be involved in outreach. So how was I going to convince them that God wanted them to be a part? We found a way to take even the most timid person, we found a way to plug that person into kingdom outreach. And some of those people turned out to be all-state soul winners. The last principle is one that I'm just a little bit, the fourth axiom is the axiom that I'm just a hair bit reluctant to dive in too deeply because of all the directions we could go. But it is the axiom, and it is also a principle, one of the five principles of growth, is the axiom of divine appointment. And the only way I know how to explain this is to tell you that the axiom of divine appointment says that if we go, and I love the story about Tom and Mary this morning because that, to me, that's so indicative of divine appointment. The divine appointment says that if we go enough, if we sow enough seeds, that somewhere along the way, we're going to encounter the seed and the place and the experience where God's already at work. It says that God is already out there before we get there. In other words, we're not running at this thing alone. He's in charge. And he's at work in the heart. Now, I'm going to be the very first one to tell you that when it comes to fishing and catching men, you know, if people tell me that they don't like to fish, I automatically know one of two things about them. I know, number one, either they've never fished or they didn't catch anything when they did fish. Because if you're successful fishing, you become a fisherman. You enjoy it. I mean, it's one of those things sort of gets in your blood. Same thing with fishing for men and women, you know, that it becomes a part of who we are. And this axiom of divine appointment, I don't understand all the things that determine which fish bites my hook and worm. Okay? I don't understand all that, but I know one thing for sure. My job is to get the hook and line in the water. I let God take care of which one gets on the hook, you know. But the principle of divine appointment says that God is at work before we get there. Do you remember the story in Acts chapter 8 about Philip and the Ethiopian? It's one of my favorite stories because this just reminds me of sometimes how I go at things. Philip, the angel of the Lord tells Philip to go down to Gaza. And let's just suppose that Philip has a revival meeting in Gaza, okay? And God says, okay, you go down to Gaza, I've got your revival meeting down there. And on the way to Gaza, he encounters the Ethiopian in the chariot. And the Ethiopian is reading from the book of Isaiah. And Philip encounters this guy, and there's a divine appointment there waiting to happen. And Philip says, hey, what you doing? And I'm paraphrasing, by the way. What are you doing? I'm reading from this Isaiah. And Philip said, do you understand what you're reading? The guy says, well, no, how can I know unless someone tells me? And so Philip jumps over in the chariot with him. I just can picture that happening. Jumps over to his chariot and starts explaining to him that all this is about Jesus, the Messiah, the suffering servant, all of that. And the Ethiopian gets saved, born again right there and baptized. And Philip never makes it down to Gaza. And he ends up back in Jerusalem. Now, if that happened to us, I'm on my way to revival. There's a lost man at the filling station. I say, well, you know, I'd love to witness that guy, but I've got to get down to my revival meeting. I've got an appointment down in Gaza, First Baptist Church, Gaza. And along, have you ever noticed the number of divine appointments that God has for us along the way? Really, that's what Matthew 28 really is all about. You know, as you are going to make disciples. In other words, the majority of our divine appointments happen along the way. We're in such a hurry to get there that we miss the divine appointments along the way. And what I'm sharing with you this morning is I am a strong believer in organized outreach. Anytime I talk about outreach and grow, invariably there's someone who will come up and say to me, they'll say, when I preach it, now, you know that I don't have to be a part of an organized outreach night to be a good witness. And I say you're absolutely right. Theoretically, you're absolutely right. But also, theoretically, statistically speaking, if you choose not to be involved in an organized outreach effort, there's a real good chance you're not going to do it on a day-to-day basis either, you know. Because people who are involved in an organized outreach evangelism ministry are more likely to be a witness on a daily basis. And I said, that really is the key here. The key of divine appointment says that if we will go enough, if we will sow enough seeds, if we will do the farming, then we're going to have the awesome and wonderful privilege and experience of divine appointment. I could tell you the night when, on a Grove night at West Jackson, when we were in the building, old building downtown, and we had a lady, and I won't share her name, but we had a lady who came in that day. I had buried her mother. We'd had her funeral, and I think it was the G team that night, and this daughter, she came on to outreach that night, and I was surprised to see her because we'd been at the funeral that day, and she said, you know, Brother Jerry, I didn't want to stay at home alone tonight. I just wanted to come and I want to write letters tonight. I just want to sit here and write letters and sort of get all this off my mind and heart. And I said, well, that's fine, it's okay. And so she sat down and started writing letters, and another lady did not have a partner to go out with her to be a part of the visiting that night. And so she walks up to this lady and said, would you go with me? And she said, well, you know, I really don't feel like it, but yeah, I'll go with you. And so they go out to make a visit that night. And while they're visiting, they visit a young single lady. And when they knock on the door, they go in, and as they're talking with this young lady, as they're talking with her about West Jackson and about the Lord, just sort of doing the little visit thing, this young single lady gets a call. And this call is bad news. Because this call tells her that her mother in North Carolina has just died. And this lady from our church says, you're not going to believe this. I just buried my mother today. And at that moment, she was able to be there. And what I'm saying, do you think for one moment that was just a coincidence? You know, it's divine appointment. I can tell you about the church in Mississippi. Some of you have heard me share this story before, particularly those of you around West Jackson. It's one of those wonderful, wonderful stories of divine appointment. In this rural town in South Mississippi, they were doing Grow, and I'd gone back to do a follow-up banquet the year after they'd started Grow. And the pastor there said, I got to tell you this story. And I said, what is it? He said, when we first started doing Grow, one of the outreach nights, we were preparing to go out, and he said, in our church, there is a Russian couple. Now, don't ask me what a Russian couple is doing in rural South Mississippi, but apparently they had been involved in a co-op during college. They became Christians while they were in college, I think in Jackson, and they were employed in Jackson, but they lived in this little community there, and being new Christians, they just went to the First Baptist Church, Brookhaven. And on that night of outreach, this young Russian did what any new Christian ought to do. I mean, this church talking about evangelism, so he signs up for Grow, and he's ready to go out visiting. Speaks hardly any English, and the pastor does with him what coaches do with kids. We don't know what to do. He takes them with him, you know. And he goes out with the pastor that night to visit. And on the way to the visit, pastor said, I was praying the whole way, Lord, please don't let these people be at home. And yes, for those of you who are not pastors, sometimes we pray that prayer too. Lord, don't let them be at home. I'm tired and I'll have a long day, just don't let them be at home. I'm going to make the effort, sow the seed, but I don't want. And guess what? They weren't at home. He starts back to the church. And God begins to convict him about another family, a family that he does not know. It's a family that someone had given him their names, that he lived in the community there, and they were not in church, they were unchurched. And he said, the more I drove, the more God convicted me that he wanted me to go see this family who was really not even on our prospect file. And he said, before I know it, I'm sitting in their driveway, me and my Russian buddy, you know. And he said, I go to the door, I knock on the door, this lady comes to the door, and she is just distraught. She's been crying. She's upset, and he says, this is my name, I'm First Baptist Church, and we came to talk with you about our fellowship, but obviously I've caught you at a very bad time. We'll come back another time, but is there anything we can do to help you? And she said, no, there's not anything that anybody can do. He said, what do you mean? And she said, well, come on in. He walks in, sitting on the couch. He notices her husband there, and he's obviously been crying too. And she said, this may sound silly to you guys, but she said, we've been trying to have children for years. And we've not been able to have children on our own biologically. And we applied for adoption. And we had not been successful in the adoption process. There were some little hiccups and obstacles along the way. And we were not able to do that. So we applied for international adoption. And we thought things were going okay. We were supposed to get this information. We're on this deadline. And we're supposed to get this information in the mail. We're supposed to get this 2 weeks ago. But it just arrived today. And it's going to be back in 2 or 3 days. And she said, we got this in the mail today. And of all things, it's written in Russian. And this pastor said, ma'am, you're not going to believe me. But I have with me tonight probably the only Russian in this whole area. And sure enough, they were able to sit down around the kitchen table that night, and that young Russian Christian helped them fill out the information, did a little translation, got it all filled out, got it all mailed back. That young couple had a precious little baby girl in about 6 months. They became involved in the church there. It's a wonderful, wonderful story that really is all about divine appointment. And that same story, over and over again, in stories about salvation, people who are born again, God putting us in the right place at the right time, the willing witness where we intersect the work of the Holy Spirit. Again, I don't understand the entire process. I don't pretend to. But I know that my job as a pastor, my job as a Christian, is to make sure that my hook's in the water and that I'm in the process of fishing or farming, or whatever we want to call it. The point is, this axiom of divine appointment, God says, you're not going at this alone. I'm already at work before you get there. And I understand there are probably many, many more axioms, truths, that cannot really be debated about outreach and kingdom outreach and kingdom growth. But these are the four that probably have meant the most to me. I'll repeat them again quickly. The axiom of absolute purpose of God, which is redemption. Axiom two, the axiom of guaranteed harvest. If we sow the seeds, God will bring some harvest. Again, let me say, God doesn't guarantee us that every seed will come up, but one thing's for certain, if we don't sow any seeds, nothing will come up, all right? Third axiom, the axiom of spiritual reproduction. The fourth axiom is the axiom of divine appointment. I am going to stop right there and ask if you have any questions before we take a break. And I'm going to come back and kind of put some legs on these and ideas on the next time I'm up. Questions? All right, Dr. Fowler.
All right, thank you, Dr. Tidwell. That was a real challenging word for us, and there's going to be more good words to come today. Let me give you a little bit of a few details about our schedule for the next little bit. We're going to gather at 11:30 in Coburn Dining Room, which if you'll walk through the cafeteria, which is to our right, there is a dining room in the far corner.